number of unifying principles to our sabbatical. And one of them was hospitality. We found that we were the recipients of phenomenal hospitality wherever we went. And I think we provided hospitality for some of the people that we spent time with because we weren't in a hurry, because we had time. So I think that one of the things that we provided people that we spent time with was a kind of hospitality of patience, and how delighted we were to be engaged in conversation. And we arrived, we flew, we met in New York, had a couple of days with our two older children in New York, and flew to Holland, where we are, and another defining principle of our sabbatical was partnership. And we arrived in Holland and were picked up by some of our partners who we share a partnership with St. Peter in Transylvania. And these are people that Rob and I have met in meetings about Transylvania. And actually some of the partner church people will be gathering in Transylvania this May in another triangle meeting. But we arrived completely jet-lagged and exhausted, and they thought we had come from France, from a meditation retreat, and that we were totally ready to consult with them. And so our 3 days there were a number of consultations and meetings with the leaders of that congregation, which we were a bit surprised by, but it was a wonderful. We could provide a kind of hospitality because we didn't have an agenda. So we could.
But they did.
Right. So we could meet and greet, and we had a lot of meetings and conversations and consultations with members of this congregation.
And their agenda is that they are a liberal church in a country which is almost entirely secularized, and they see no future for their church. And they thought we could help them solve that.
Which we did, no problem.
So that was our now we're going to India. I think. Yes.
We arrived in New Delhi and went immediately to Amritsar, where we simply caught a taxi and went to a small heritage village called Pragpur, where we stayed in a remarkable heritage hotel called the Judge's Court. We did this because we knew we needed a place to just decompress. So we had 2 days in this idyllic, wonderful site, and for the first night, we were the only guests with a staff of 18.
which was a little embarrassing.
Which was very difficult for us as Minnesotans, and we had a very hard time accepting their hospitality.
And then the second night, a young couple, newlywed, from Delhi, came, and they were in the hotel with us. And then that night, it started to get, at about 1 o'clock in the morning, it started to get noisy. It was really noisy, and cars kept pulling in with radios blaring, and I threw bottles of water out the window to shut
plastic them. Bottles.
Plastic bottles.
Not terribly effective.
And we discovered, this is Jan with the neighborhood dog walking in the village.
Because I miss Maggie.
We discovered that, unbeknownst to us, Judge's Court had been booked for a Bollywood movie production. And this is the leading lady and man of a Bollywood wedding film that was filmed at Judge's Court that day. And once we understood what it was okay.
The male star, everyone on staff was all a Twitter that he was there. And they were terribly excited. And what we didn't know is that he was raised in Canada.
He's from Vancouver.
In Vancouver, that he grew up in British Columbia, but he wanted a place where he could make a career as a singer and actor. And what we didn't know is that Bollywood is populated by Canadian and American Indians who then return to India because they can have a good, solid, many of them have a good, solid career there. And he was gracious and wonderful, invited us onto the set, and I was completely in his glow.
Now, this is Jan's birthday. That's part of why we went to this very cool little hotel, which was the residence of the Chief Justice of India during the Raj. So it was faded elegance, quite wonderful. This is a rather typical Hindu shrine.
In a small village.
And Jan made oblation there for her birthday.
And that on that walk we saw a mongoose, which was very thrilling for
mongoose.
Me.
A mongoose.
Blessing and
making
salutation.
An offering and being blessed in turn.
Now we are in Dharamsala, and because of the level of pollution in the air in India, the natural environment, other than the mountains, does not give you a lot of color. All the color are in the women's garments, and they are so beautiful. And just such a gift.
The air is very smoky, even in small towns.
Right.
Dharamsala is the capital, is the home in exile of the Dalai Lama. We went to Dharamsala to spend time with the Tibetan Buddhists, and that's what we're about to do. The Tibetan community has a college called the Institute for Buddhist Dialectics. Originally, the Institute for Buddhist Dialectics trained only monks, and the Tibetans historically only educate monks, which is one of the prime concerns of the Chinese about the Tibetans, is that they have historically been extremely hierarchical and have only educated the people they thought were the best and the brightest. In the last 6 months, however, the Dalai Lama's government has issued a new educational policy in which they confess to that problem and say that henceforth everyone will be educated and extensively quote Dewey. They're moving toward a student-centered educational philosophy which attempts to find, to bring out the gifts of every individual.
Which is grounded on wisdom, loving kindness, and generosity are the three defining principles and guiding lights of their educational policies.
The woman at the desk is Karen Harris, who is the Unitarian Universalist minister in Arcata, California, and the minister of some close friends of ours, which is how we ended up there. She and her husband, Steve, are the only Americans on faculty at the Institute for Buddhist Dialectics. She is there largely to work with people preparing to be teachers. This is a class of teachers. She is introducing or helping them to learn about the new policy and to apply the new policy in their minds to how they're going to organize their classrooms. This is a radical shift for them. Steve, she's a Sanskrit scholar. Steve, her husband, is a Buddhist studies scholar from Harvard.
With a specialty in the Tibetan language.
In Tibetan language. And he runs the Emory University semester abroad in India. Emory University has a unique relationship with the Tibetans. They, in fact, have put the Dalai Lama on faculty, and the Tibetan community, whether we like to know it or not, floats significantly on Coke money.
Coca-Cola.
Well, I figured you'd make the Atlanta Emory connection, but perhaps not. So we had the honor of attending this class with the Tibetans. Now, we don't have a picture of them debating, But they're taught from early childhood, they're taught debate as a martial art. So when they say Institute for Buddhist Dialectics, they mean dialectics. They're taught like a first-ranked law school teaches. So where they argue one side of an issue one day and the opposite side the next day, and they're to argue with equal skill and equal passion. And they don't just argue, they do this.
We stood on the balcony, and they meet in groups of threes. And we stood on the balcony, and they were doing their debate class on the basketball field, or basketball court, excuse me. They love basketball, but they love debating more.
And when they make a point, they'll do this. And then the opposite, their opposite will leap back at them. They don't actually make contact, but they threaten each other.
It's just like that.
It's
so you hear all this slapping, and these people are leaping in the air, and so we stood on the balcony just like, we watched them for about half an hour, 45 minutes.
Now, the Dalai Lama's monastery is surrounded by a stone, you walk into it in a spiral along a stone foundation wall, and on that stone foundation wall is this. Now, we don't know why this is there.
Because he's a Unitarian Universalist and doesn't know it.
This could, we were kind of surprised to see it.
Is that the way the Tibetan
script? That is Tibetan, that is Tibetan script, yeah.
On a Padme Om.
This is not the Dalai Lama's monastery. This is one of his closest associates. This is actually the monastery of, I don't know his name, the monk who initiated the woman who we're going to show you in a minute.
Right. And what I want to say is that when we were here, I mean, there are monks 3 and 4 years old who were running around, you know, being little boys. And Karen had just gone to a monk's 5th birthday party. And she said, you know, you somehow expect them to be different than other 5-year-olds, but they were just like wild little 5-year-old boys running around in their little crimson robes. And
so because of the overcast and because it was winter, you can't see, nor could we, that
ever.
There are 22,000 foot mountains.
We never saw them.
If this sky was clear, the Himalayas would be the background, but we never saw them.
I know I've said this in a sermon, but monks, all Buddhist monks, wear colors of crimson and gold. And they do this to signify and symbolize ripe fruit. Because they are on the path of dropping off the tree of suffering. And so that's why they wear the colors that they do.
This is just prayer flags at the top of the monastery.
The idea of prayer flags, for those of you who don't know, is that your prayers go up into the air, and the prayer flags then take all the prayers of the world and pass them along. And that's the image of the Tibetans, that the prayers of people in St. Paul, Minnesota are in the air, joined with the prayers that are coming out of the monastery.
This is an incense factory inside the monastery, and we brought incense from this factory back.
This is one of the ways that they make money for the monastery.
This is a prayer wheel. It's about 18 feet high, and it's another image of spinning the prayers off into the world.
And this is the Dalai Lama.
You walk around it and it rings a bell. That's the Dalai
Lama's
prayer wheel.
Can you comment on, say, the reality of this? In other words, is it maybe anchored in tradition? Is it a symbolic idea? Or is there a more fundamentalist sense that it actually is spinning off an active prayer?
No, I wouldn't use the word fundamentalist. I would use the word, they would use the word science. They call this inner science. And they do not think, they what you and I might think is mythic or mythological, they experience as demonstrable, proven over millennia. They call things like what a prayer wheel can do inner science, and they have a couple of thousand years of evidence.
That's part of it. So is
Wait. There's a split. There are machines that do it. The question is it the spinning of the wheel which generates or somehow maintains the prayer, or is it the way we would tend to believe it is the quality that the person achieves in spinning the wheel that makes them prayerful. And the movement is actually split on it. There's an American Tibetan sect in New Mexico that's building that machine. But there are also Tibetans who, and I think the Dalai Lama is one of them, who would get exactly what you mean. That it's in the practice of the spinning that the person becomes the prayer.
The Dalai Lama has made himself available, and his other monks, kind of the top monks, have made themselves available to scientists all over the world who are studying neuroanatomy. And they had just connected the Dalai Lama to some major machine, and what they discovered is after like 3 minutes of meditation, that the brain waves became a blue orb, and which is what they're trying to achieve. And there it was, and demonstrable on the machines. And now we can talk about Anitta.
Kali.
Oh, this is a crone version of.
Now we're in Hinduism.
And of course, throughout India, you'll leave a Tibetan temple and immediately go to a Hindu one that's right next door. But this is a crone version of Kali, the goddess of life and destruction. And she was by far the most popular deity at the temple, which was very interesting to me. And you can't really see it in this picture, but her bones are quite visible when you get up close.
And this is a necklace of skulls. She's
people she's devoured.
She's intense. This is Donald Duck.
Our favorite deity in India.
You want to talk about Krishna?
Well, this is a Krishna temple. And Krishna, you know, is a very high-end, mighty god. And so they have a mediating influence, which is the cow. And you will come to the temple and you will see...
Nandi, right? Nandi the bull.
Nandi. And you will see people whispering in Nandi's ears. And so people will come to Nandi and say their prayers to Nandi in the belief that their prayer will then go to Krishna through Nandi. And if you see ruins of a temple, and we did numerous times, if you see Nandi, then you know that it was a Krishna temple. Yes.
Yes. This is Karen walking with Ani Tenzin Palmo. Ani Tenzin Palmo is the second Western woman ordained by the Tibetans. She was ordained in 1964, which is really early in this dynamic. She's English. She knew from a very early age that she was in the wrong place. She discovered Buddhism through Alan Watts, and that began her path. She spent 12 years living by herself in a cave at 18,000 feet, entering into the extremely ascetic tradition of the Tibetans. For a number of those years, she slept in a box, which meant she didn't lie down for a year. And she is very close to an enlightened being. Her goal in life is to prove to the Tibetan hierarchy, which is quite patriarchal, that it is possible to be enlightened in a woman's body in one lifetime.
And we think she may accomplish it. And I want to follow up. This is a tangential answer to you, Michael. The Tibetans believe very much in magic. And it's a very magical-based philosophy, which is different than other forms of Buddhism. So they believe in demons. They believe in the bardo as what happens when you die, which is a multi-stage process that you go through in letting go of this life. And for people who've been enlightened, they believe in a thing called rainbow death, where the body actually disintegrates, and all that's left is hair and teeth, and the flesh disappears. And if you're truly enlightened, then what emerges is a rainbow. And we met a monk who said that when he was in Tibet, he had the experience of watching a valley fill up, when his master died, watching the valley fill up with rainbows, having the rainbows dance down the valley, come into the monastery, and pick up his master and go on. And this is the kind of thing that they absolutely believe in. Now, this is very different than what other Buddhists believe. It's by far the most magical of all the Buddhist sects.
So you can see why there would be rather intense conflict between the extremely materialistic worldview of the Chinese communists and the radically magical, mythic worldview of the Tibetans, which they see as medieval. They see them as medieval oppressors. She's building a monastery, a convent.
64.
She's building a convent. It's the first convent the Tibetans have built in exile. She is among those who are advocates for the Tibetan community letting go of the dream of returning to Tibet. And the Dalai Lama is actually kind of right on the verge. That's part of the educational philosophy, that they're making a home in India. The chances of the Dalai Lama being allowed to return to China, to Tibet, it's virtually nil. It's not going to happen.
But the whole community has been based on this myth of return.
You should chime
so
in
they've sort of been living a temporary life and not setting up infrastructures. And they realize that the Tibetans have become quite, they've lagged behind their neighbors in northern India because of that, because they haven't made put roots down in the life they have in Dharamsala. And so part of what Ani is doing is trying to help people put down roots in northern India by creating this monastery, primarily for Tibetan women.
We are now leaving northern India and flying, what?
To Amritsar.
Yeah, but it's not, not the order the slides ended up in.
Okay.
So what we really did was we drove out to Amritsar, and we'll get there. But in the meantime, we're going to fly down to Maharashtra, to what used to be called Bombay. It is now called Mumbai, to visit a man named Vivek Pandit. The Unitarian Universalist Association controls a trust. Oh, I'm glad you're here, because I want you to meet him. Bye. A trust which generates $700,000 or $800,000 a year and has to be spent on good works in India. It's called the Holdeen Trust. And we decided in the early 80s that this money would be spent to support a group of community organizers over a long period of time, that we were not going to be project-based, but instead we were going to support a continuing effort in a number of communities. One of those communities is on the outskirts of Mumbai, and it's led by Vivek Pandit. Vivek is a Brahmin who came out of college having already taken the Brahmin's vows, wearing the sacred thread, came out of college and was moved to do something. He and his wife were moved to do something for the poor in the village where his uncle lived. And they went and they started to organize, and they were beaten almost to death for trying to organize among the Dalits. Dalit is a word that's now used, it means the same thing as untouchable used to mean. Vivek started an organization called Vidayak Sansad, whose primary focus was for a great many years freeing indentured servants. There are still a number of million slaves in India. They're called indentured servants, but they're indentured from generation to generation. So your grandfather needed money to pay for a wedding, but the debt hasn't been paid off, and you're indentured to the money lender, who then invests you in a farm, usually. Could be a factory. This is illegal, but the laws aren't enforced. So Vivek assembled a small private army and began to enforce the law.
But more importantly, Vivek told people, you are free. You have internal freedom. No one can take your sense of freedom away from you. And that is what he preaches, is that internal liberation, which is so similar to Unitarian Universalism and to Buddhism. So it's very interesting.
Some of the people involved in the partner church movement, some of you have been to Transylvania and you know about this, where congregations are matched with congregations in Transylvania and we work together and learn from each other. Some of those people have been pushing the Holdeen Trust to consider establishing partnerships with the Holdeen between the Holdeen programs in India and some of our stronger congregations. We have been asked to consider establishing a partnership with Vidayak Sansad, with Vivek Pandit. And we wanted to go and talk with him about that possibility. Here's what he told us he wanted originally. He wanted us to be involved in a conversation with him about how to design a religious way which was compelling enough to be useful to newly liberated people and still enshrined intellectual freedom. And we said to Vivek, we would be glad to talk with you about that, and if you have anything to teach us, we could sure use it. Suffice to say that he is dealing with hundreds of thousands of people who are newly freed and are leaving the confines of the compounds that he has set up where they can live when they're first liberated and joining cults, because it's much easier to free the body than it is to free the mind. And he wants help. So he's coming to see us in November, and we'll talk more about that later. This is Jatropha. Jatropha. Jatropha is a plant that will grow in some of the poorest soil in the world with very little water. Nothing will eat it, no animals eat it, and its oil content is extremely high. So Vivek wants to talk to whoever wants to talk to him about it, about Jatropha as a source for biodiesel, and Jatropha as a crop that could conceivably be planted on forest track on land that's owned by the government that isn't used for anything right now. And he's coming in early November to meet with all your best friends and to talk about Jatropha. We also have an institute called the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy in Minneapolis that has a Jatropha project, a biodiesel project, that they're going to work on with him.
One of the things that was shocking for me being in India, I hadn't been there since 1973, is the amount of eucalyptus that has been planted. Actually, everywhere we went, we saw it in Greece, we saw it in India, and we saw it in northern Spain. And the only place that eucalyptus is native is Australia. And we're very familiar with eucalyptus because it's all over Northern California. And it's very acidic, and nothing grows underneath it. And it grows very quickly, which is its appeal. But it was shocking to us to find it wherever we went. And Jatropha, we're hoping, is going to be something that could replace eucalyptus and last a long time and be hardy, but for very different reasons than lumber.
It doesn't grow
and
like a tree.
Right, it doesn't grow like a tree.
So, Vidyaks, some of you will recognize this. In our social justice work, our community outreach work here at Unity Church, we ask that each of our teams consider three aspects to their work: direct service, education, and advocacy. And that all three of those things have to be held together in order to do effective work. Vivek started Vidyak Sansad, they started freeing people, and then they realized that they had to impact policy. This is a team of young lawyers, mostly. Their offices are in Mumbai. They are a advocacy and pressure group that works with the legislature in Maharashtra. And they're really talented. And it looks like Vidyak Sansad is going to replicate this with the national government. You begin to see how the money that we've invested over now close to 30 years begins to make a difference. Most of the funding sources would fund a single project by a team like this, but would never fund the team. We fund the team. You want to do this?
Well, one of the things that they have done is set up schools in agricultural areas so that children are educated, because normally what would happen is they'd be immediately put to work. And this is a school, we saw numerous schools in brick kilns. And the teenagers and the young adults into early middle age were working the brick kilns. But the weight of the bricks is so heavy that you can't do it beyond about 30, 35.
Child labor is still legal in India. It's considered a cultural, it's part of the culture. So they have never subscribed to the anti-child labor agreements worldwide.
So they're training teachers and then placing these teachers, creating these schools, and it's quite remarkable. Now, most of these children are first of their families ever to attend a school.
They call them Banga schools, and I don't know why, what the term means. These kids all work. They're in school for 2-3 hours a day. And these are brick kiln kids, so that what they do mostly is carry buckets of earth. Then their older siblings are carrying the bricks on their heads. And I had some pictures of that, but I don't know if they got in here or not. These are two men who are tribals, who live in this forest and are talking with us about their hopes for, this is in a Jatropha grove. The problem with anything, any scheme like this though, is that you have to own the means of production. Anybody ever heard this term before? And Vivek is coming over here in part to figure out the question of who's going to actually produce biodiesel and how's it going to be distributed. They planted 1.5 million Jatropha plants last year, but that doesn't kind of do the job quite yet. Okay, this woman expressing excitement is Kathy Sridhar, who is the executive director of the Holdeen Trust and has been since its inception. She was Sergeant Shriver's secretary at the start of the Peace Corps. She goes way back in the NGO community. And this is the flag raising, which they do every day in a very formal way. They're very patriotic. They're very deeply invested in the future of India at Vidyak Sansad, which is a compound where Vivek lives with maybe 60 or so other adults and a private prep school for tribal girls. Before we went to India, there was a speaker who came to Wellspring Wednesday from McAllister. Mm-hmm. David?
Jim.
Jim what?
Jim Lane.
Yes. Who said the most significant marker of progress in the developing world is the literacy of women. That as women become capable of reading, the culture changes. And Vivek is trying to do that. And one of the places he wants unity to connect is he would like us to send teachers for, 3 to 6 months at a time to work with the girls. These girls are, as I say, they're all tribals. No one in their family has ever been educated. They come to this compound, which is about 2 hours out of Mumbai, and they live quite a disciplined life. They get up every morning at 6:30, they get dressed, they go down to a meditation hall. They meditate, they chant, they do some calisthenics, and then they stand in a circle and they sing We Shall Overcome. This woman was She was a slave. She's now on a village council, and she's talking about that experience.
She's actually head of her village council at this point. This is, so they also train community organizers who go into the village, and we went to see some of the youth work, and it's all, they all are taught these disciplines, these practices, and one of them is always, what's the word for unity?
Zindabad,
and that means unity, and they say it over and over again.
That's their chant is unity, 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 unity. It's freaking interesting.
And Mark Peek is the deputy director of the Unitarian Universalist Service Committee. And Mark traveled with us to India, and he's done a lot of work all over the world, but worked a lot with children in Asia. And he introduced himself as the place where, because we were all given bouquets, he came from the place where people wore flowers on their heads. And he was so silly, and these boys were, of course, immediately liberated to be silly too. So it was just so wonderful. So we spent a couple of hours with these kids, playing with these flowers, letting them be kids and be silly with Mark, and it was really wonderful.
We're back at the brick kilns.
We're back at the brick kilns.
These girls are 16, 17, 18. By the time they're in their mid-20s, their spines will be so badly curved that they won't be able to do this work anymore. And that's one of the issues. There are many issues.
And beautiful, beautiful children.
This is Kathy Sridhar again, and Kay Montgomery, who's the executive vice president of the UUA, and that's who we traveled with was Kathy, Kay Montgomery, who's she's chief of staff for the denomination, and she's quite wonderful, and Mark McPeak. I like that picture. He has just said to us, "I was born in a cattle shed. Mr. Vivek came to me and told me I was not an animal. Now I lead a union of 160,000 men." When Vivek gets a call and is asked to come and help in a situation, his standard response is, "Call me when you have 1,000 people that I can speak to." And he won't show up until then.
So remember that on the Sunday that he's preaching. We need 1,000 of you to show up. You know, I can't tell you the level of vision and courage, commitment, and compassion that we experienced with these people that we met through the whole Dean Project, and the lives that we saw visibly being changed. We were just totally inspired by the work that's being done there.
Ecstatic, beautiful children. The first thing that Vivek, that the Holding Trust did when they decided to support Vivek was bring him to the United States and send him to Highlander. Does anybody know what Highlander is? A few of you do, okay. Highlander is a school. I don't even know if it still exists.
It does.
I think it does.
Absolutely.
In Tennessee, that trains community organizers.
Trained Rosa Parks.
Trained Martin King. His name was Miles Horton. He's gone now, but it's a marvelous place.
But his work does continue.
And this is, I don't remember what this form is called, but this is the tribal's, this grows out of tribal hieroglyphics, what we would call hieroglyphics. And it's scratched into cow dung. And these are images of protests. I actually have one of these, which is out being framed. This is back to the Tibetan stuff. This is out of order. Ani Tenzin Palmo's guru, her teacher, is buried in this stupa. And a Bodhi tree grew up through it. And they tried to stop it because they were worried about it breaking the stupa. But every time they killed it, it grew back. So that's what that is. That's a Bodhi tree. These are the roots coming down through it. And of course, they see that as a particular kind of a proof text.
It's a sign.
Oh, now we're back in Amritsar.
And this is the Golden Temple, which is the holy site for the Sikhs. Sikhism is a relatively new religion, founded in the 1500s. It was an effort to bridge Hinduism and Islam. And we found being at the Golden Temple very powerful to be with all these mostly extended families and families going through together.
Men and women together,
and it's very it's a very family-oriented religion, and the men. It was originally founded as a religion of peace, but they were persecuted a lot, and now the men are, there's a very much a warrior tradition that comes out of Sikhism. And there's a lot of conflict between the Sikhs, as we know, and the Hindus. And the Golden Temple is where the violence occurred against the Sikhs that eventually caused Indira Gandhi's death. This is in Amritsar, which is the capital.
Up.
Right, we're out of order.
I have no experience doing slideshows on a computer. So this is amazing that you're seeing anything.
And
this is Amritsar,
which is the capital of Punjab,
which is in the northwest, We're 40 miles from the Pakistani border.
Punjab.
Punjab, yeah.
No. We were told not to go to Kashmir.
That's the pool of immortality. And the temple sits on a little peninsula out in the pool. No,
no.
This is a typical day.
It took us about 40 minutes to walk around and through.
There were 80,000 people.
And there's a major hymn singing tradition in Sikhism. And they have a constant chanting. Hymn singing.
It's chanting out of the book.
Yeah, but they call it hymn singing.
Do they?
Yeah.
Okay, now we're back in Mumbai. This is Elephanta, which is one of 15 or so what? No, it's not Roman. It's Hindu. But it's carved out of the sheer rock. This is not that old. It's maybe 12th century. It's newer than a lot of places. And I just thought it was a cool picture. It's on an island in the bay. Color.
Yeah, the colors of India are just so wonderful.
This is called the Gateway of India. It was built to welcome George VI. Late Raj to Mumbai, yes. Well, to India. That's the yacht club behind you, right? This is the express laundry in Mumbai. This is Gandhi's bedroom in Mumbai.
We went both to his house in Mumbai, and then we went to his ashram, as I said, on Sunday in Ahmedabad.
This is Vivekananda, and he's there because he's a very interesting character. He was a journalist and a renowned doubter who went to see the great 19th century Indian Saint Ramakrishna, thinking to expose him as a charlatan, and was instead immediately and forever changed by the encounter. It's said that when he arrived in the hall along the Ganges, that Ramakrishna raised his hand and the place went quiet, and he saw him in the back of the room and motioned him forward, and he came forward, and Ramakrishna said to him, "How would you like to talk about your God with or without form?" Which brought him up short. He was the person who brought Hinduism to North America. He was the first Indian sage to come to set foot on North American soil.
Came to the World Congress in 1893.
And when he did, he came into the port of Oakland, California, and was carried on a litter to the Unitarian Church, which was the only place in the Bay Area that would allow him to speak. And our pulpit back in the Oakland Church is a shrine to the Vedanta Society, which is the organization that he founded. So two or three times a year, people would come from India and strew flowers on our pulpit.
After we left Mumbai, we went to Ahmedabad, and our first encounter was with the people who founded the Self-Employment Women's Association, SEWA, which started with five women and now has 1 million members. It was founded by a woman named Ella Bhatt, who was considered for the Nobel Peace Prize last year. She is absolutely remarkable. And this, we spent our first day out in the field. This is meeting with agricultural workers. And these women were pretty much totally disempowered in their lives. And the union came and, in many cases, taught them to read, helped organize them, sometimes taught them to ride bicycles, help them figure out ways to preserve and hold water. And we spent 3 hours with these women. And why don't you continue with some of the pictures? I mean, we fell so in love with these women.
SEWA is one of the great model NGOs in the world. It's been replicated all over the world. They teach all over the world. They have a bank. They have a couple of major factories where they bring piece embroidery, you know, embroidered pieces of cloth together and produce fabric, produce clothing for the Western market. It's a truly remarkable organization. And again, Ella Bott met Kathy Sridhar in 1981, and we've been funding them ever since. And what happened in terms of large-scale funding is that Kathy, who went to Radcliffe, was friends with the president of the Ford Foundation. So the bigger of these organizations all got Ford money after that followed the Holdeen money. So the Holdeen money helped spark it and is still there, but we don't pay for this. In fact, this is mostly...
SEWA has nine departments. One of them is the bank. The other is the agricultural workers. They have a organizing arm for rag pickers and garment workers. And Shantiban, which we will explain.
We'll visit Shantiban. She's just strong.
So these women started in the beginning. It was primarily the older women, more established women. Many of these women are heads of village councils now. And they talked about, just like Jim Lane did in his presentation back in January, what happened when women took charge in these villages after centuries of the men being in charge and, frankly, squandering things. And because the women...
In some cases.
Well, frankly, in a lot of cases, because just as Jim Lane said in his presentation, women will put the needs of their family first. So family and then community. And men often, frankly, I'm sorry that this sounds so sexist, will put their own self-interest ahead of the needs of the family and the community. So organizing these women has just transformed these villages. This woman, once she got started, she started preaching. And we didn't have any idea what she was saying, but she just got everybody all excited about what they could do and what they were doing. And
she's someone who found the organization and is now working for the organization.
Right.
Almost everybody that works for them has come up through the organization itself. They're there to meet with us. We were a delegation, and we were led by their original funder. So there was, you know, they were gathered to meet us.
It's great to hear what you have learned from them. What did they learn from you?
That's an interesting question.
I think I'd like to answer that question with Shantiban.
Oh, and Shantiban. This is only here because it's the best picture I took. And because they're, you know, because this was a dog and pony show, they were supposed to be happy. They were supposed to show us that their lives had changed, that the union had helped them. And this woman is pensive. And she's thinking about something that is not happening in that room, but is very real for her.
Russ, you had your hand up.
Programs like this still just a drop in the bucket in India.
Yes.
Yes. Yes. Even sure. With a million members. But what I do want to say, Michael, is I think what we brought, because I think we all felt so related to these women. And I think what they experienced was that sense of relatedness and connectedness. Because by the end, we were hugging and kissing and crying, and which I did not expect going into this gathering. Now, that did not happen everywhere. But these, at this gathering it did, and with the Shantiban it did. And we'll explain the Shantiban.
So now we're out in the field, and these are the salt workers. These are all self-employed people. This is the Self-Employed Women's Association, right? So the salt workers go out into a salt flat, a vast salt flat, and they leach the salt out of the soil. And they do it by bringing the water up, drying it out, and then they tread it.
They walk on it. They press it with their feet.
And to the point where their feet are preserved and can't be burned in the guts.
Because it was winter, it was only 90 degrees in the salt flats. It can get as hot as 130, 120 during the summer.
And all over the salt flats, there are boats just sitting around. Because when the monsoons come, the salt flats become a sea, an inland sea, and they fish them.
And the wild asses of India are all over the salt flats, too.
I didn't put those pictures in.
Well, many of these agricultural workers are from some of the lowest castes. And
of course.
You bet.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
We're not knowledgeable enough to go into that in depth. Suffice to say that there are 3,000 castes.
And
the complexity of the social structure is astounding. And I'm a little concerned that the impression we're giving here is that India is a place where everyone is desperate. And that's not true. And these many of these people are very poor, but they are not miserable. They are not desperately unhappy in their poverty. And Americans tend to think to equate the two, but it isn't necessarily the case. And I just want to be very clear that I am a novice in understanding this situation at all. It's hugely complex.
We tried to read history of India, Indian politics, trying to get as educated as we could. And as Rob said, we just scratched the surface.
So this is salt being leached from the soil. This is salt.
And this is industrial grade salt. And the salt workers can work 8 months out of the year. Most of the agricultural workers are bound to one crop and have to survive on what they make from that one crop. And so they only work 3 months out of the year as agricultural workers.
Following the last major earthquake in Pakistan, which also affected the border areas like this, the Unitarian Universalist congregations around the country raised money for relief. This is a house that was rebuilt with Unitarian Universalist money. This is showing the Western earthquake-proofing design. That is a rainwater retention well. Each of these rebuilt houses had a rainwater retention well installed. This makes a huge difference because these are people who...
These women were walking some 12 to 16 kilometers a day to get water, which they would carry on their heads.
If you ask an African or Indian woman what the most important invention of the 20th century was, they'll tell you plastic. And it's because you can carry, because it's light and you can carry more water in it. This is Jan joining Sewa. 5 rupees.
This is Shantiban. In 2002, there were terrible race riots, or religiously based riots in Ahmedabad between the Hindus and the Muslims. And a number of, I guess, 240 people were killed.
Bunch of people.
Almost all men, and which left all these widows, and the government didn't know how to serve them, so they asked Sewa, "Will you help these women and figure out how to organize them?" And what they did is they created this organization called Shantaban, which is, means Peace Sister. And these women have created peace centers in their communities where they have become friends, where they have learned about one another's religions. So on these peace centers, with Ramadan coming up, they will have an educational forum for Hindus and Muslims alike to learn about Ramadan, with an invitation to celebrate Ramadan, even if you're a Hindu.
This is unheard of.
The women would stand up and tell us how their husbands were killed, or that they saw their husbands hacked to death with a sword or knife, but what their life had become since they had become part of Shantaban. This woman was in purdah, which means she was in isolation. The only males she came in contact with were her husband, her brothers, and her father. And she had no skills, and she lost her husband. She had 5 children, and Sewa trained her. She now has her own sewing business. But can you see
Sewa
that she
found
is holding
her in her home? She didn't leave her home.
She is holding hands with her best friend, who is a Hindu. And these women, almost all of whom are sobbing as they tell us the story of their husband's death. One of the women whose picture Rob hasn't shown saw her father, her son, and her husband murdered, but had a big enough heart to forgive. And so these women really embody peace. They are absolutely on the ground peace workers. And when violence erupts in their communities, they run out of their houses. They take charge. They will go in and break up the violence. Yeah.
They're the first responders now in Ahmedabad to communal violence. Tom?
Were you able to observe that they involved any of the men yet? How they meet each other?
No, we weren't. There were a couple of men in the room, and one of them tried to speak at one point, and it was made pretty clear pretty quickly that he was not welcome to do that. This is a women's organization. It's. Do you have your hand up, Katie? Okay.
And it's.
This is the Sewa Bank. We got 10 more minutes, right?
I'm just wondering if there are questions.
Well, people have been jumping in if they have questions. Jump in if you have a question. This is the Sewa Bank, which is one of the bigger microcredit organizations in India. This is the Sewa factory. One of the things they asked us to do was to see if we could set up a relationship with the Fashion Institute of America in New York. Why not? To help with they want to design clothing that will sell in the West using the embroidery work of rural women. It's a very interesting idea.
This is an organization that is devoted to water and water rights for the citizens. And they go in and help restore water sources. They do battle with corporations and governments. And they're doing remarkable work around water.
Nestle? No, Nescafe is just ubiquitous. It's
Nescafe is everywhere.
You want to talk about her?
You had spoken earlier about the women in prep school and about possible relationships.
Yeah.
Would they be learning English?
Yes.
They're learning Maharashtran? Hindi and English.
What use do they have in the local?
Well, the educational system is in the local dialect for elementary school. High school is in
mostly Hindi.
And mostly
in
Hindi
the north.
In the north. and then colleges in English.
It's their unifying language.
It's their unifying language, because Hindi is complicated, of course, because of the Muslims. And because of...
Because of Tamil. They don't speak it in the South.
And Tamil in the South. So it's very complicated. They tried to wipe out English because, of course, it was the language of the oppressor. But it is, in many cases, the unifying language. So it's very complicated.
This is the meditation ground by the Sabarmati River in Ahmedabad, from which Gandhi set out on the salt march. This is his ashram. Well, he had a bunch of them, but this is the one. And this is his room and his spinning wheel. Some of you will know that one of his cardinal rules was that people should make their own clothes, beginning by spinning the cotton. And the Congress Party legislators still wear khadi, the party that grew out of Gandhi's work. We're going to meet one of them in a minute. There he is. Mistry. Mistry was an economist and one of the people originally funded by Holdeen, who got into politics. He's a budget analyst by training, and he's now the majority whip of the national government. And a very sweet man. Lovely character, and he's the last person we went to see.
But what he does is he and his organization go through the national budgets and the state budgets and hold the government accountable with their budget goals. So they'll say, you have this line item for this project, and you say you've got the money, but you haven't actually sent the money to this organization or this line item or whatever. And they're doing really important work.
So that's the end of the slides. We'll be happy to respond to any other questions you may have. Vivek is coming, I think, the 5th of November, and will be part of the service on
a Wellspring Wednesday on November 7th.
He's going to do a Wellspring Wednesday lecture, and he's going to be part of the service in some way on the 11th. And there'll be a lot of opportunities to meet with him. He's a very, very interesting man.
I jumped ahead. I think what they learned is that there are people in the United States that care deeply about what's going on in India. And I think what we offered was relationship. And certainly I would never diminish the role of our funding. That we did not come in a neutral relationship. We came traveling with the head of this organization. And this money has made an incredible difference to these people, in part because it isn't project-based, it's vision-based. They don't have to keep kind of coming up with a new project to get the funding. That it's, you have a vision, you're making a difference, we will continue to fund you.
The two things that I have thought of, one is, and we've done this in Transylvania too, is that every time we heard from them about the depth of the crisis, about how hard their lives are, we talked about like struggles among people in this country. We tried to break the assumption that all Americans are moneyed and all Americans are fat and happy. We talked a lot about race and the racial dynamics in America.
Politics.
And politics.
One of the people
we
in
kept
India,
apologizing for our president.
One of the things that somebody said in India that I thought was really interesting. He says, in the role that America has now in the world, everyone in the world should be able to vote in American elections. Because who your president is has such a profound effect on our lives. And that isn't really true, as true with any other head of state, except for the U.S. currently.
Yeah, we're the big, yeah.
I thought that was very interesting.
Not a day went by, and this is not an endorsement, but not a day went by when we were in India where the English-speaking press was not talking about Barack Obama. His picture was in every paper every day. He's a hero in the third world. Just the fact that he has the guts to try to run for president is very interesting.
People really wanted to.
And the other thing that they learned from us was something Jan did, and it was in among the Shantiban. And that was that we wept for hours with them. And they were getting up one after another and telling the story of the loss of their husband or brother or son. And they were telling it in great detail, and we are not talking about people throwing rocks or getting shot. We're talking about people breaking into their homes and cutting off their husband's head in front of them. I mean, it was that kind of very bloody, very awful thing. And they needed to tell these stories. And at one point, the director of the program got up and told them to stop it. That it had been 5 years, that it was time for them to get over it, that the Americans had come to hear positive stories.
We wanted to hear happy stories.
Happy stories of positive change and the way in which our money had helped Sewa to help them. And Jan allowed this for about 30 seconds. And then she stood up with tears just streaming down her cheeks and talked about grief. And talked to them, gave them permission to be wherever they needed to be on the path of recovery, and acknowledged their grief and apologized to the director of the program, but made it very clear that she knew a lot more about what these women actually needed in that moment.
Actually, I didn't say that. But what I
did... I didn't say you said anything. You didn't have to.
What I said is that it was clear that their grief had been transformed, that the grief was still real, and that we got that. And there was no way that grief wouldn't always be present in their life, but that they had transformed it. It was like a phoenix rising, and that's what I said. Being here has been watching a phoenix rise out of the ashes of your despair, is what I said, and that was true. And the bracelet that Rob had a picture of, we all got string bracelets. And I actually came home just before going to New Orleans and had a minor medical procedure, nothing serious. When I went in for surgery, I said, I need to tell you that I have an unnatural attachment to my spring bracelet. I'll give up anything but it. Please, can I keep it? And they said, what we've discovered is that our patients do a lot better if there are certain things that we let them keep.
Like limbs.
And so I kept the string bracelet. It fell off I still have it, but it's about 3 weeks ago. And it was my bond to these women. It was like a phoenix rising, hearing their stories of empowerment and transformation.
So we were... Did they feel encouraged by us? I think to some degree. We tried to cut through the kind of artificiality of that any kind of donor and donee experience in that kind of a setting. And I hope we did to some degree.
And we challenged the donor a fair amount.
Yeah.
That's one of the
We were there in part to talk with Kathy Sridhar, who is the donor. About her role and her she experiences these people as her children. She's a little bit like that, and we were there to help her work through that.
Unpack.
We didn't lay a glove on her though.
But we at least tried to speak truth to her as we saw it, and patronizing generosity do some of that work with her. And we are going to continue to be in relationship with her around some of these issues.
And we invite you to be in relationship with, not with her particularly, but with the programs as well. If any of you plans to travel to India, there are some very interesting opportunities. If any of you or anyone you know is considering such Peace Corps or like activity, we have some interesting opportunities. Vivek will, as I say, will be here in November. This is the first of two or three of these evenings. There are other stories to tell. We didn't think it was wise to try to give you a sweep travelogue of the whole thing. I hope you enjoyed it. I want to honor the time, and it's 8:30. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you very much. And thank you for your really important and provocative questions. Thank you.